address our climate crisis, we'll have to change government policies and possibly even topple governments. We cannot let the Bush administration prevent us from moving forward at these negotiations. But to fully address the problem, we must fundamentally restructure our societies and our economies. And we must do it on a global scale. It is the challenge of our generation to begin that restructuring. So while we confront the company that tries to build a power plant in a marginalized community, we must also redesign our cities and our homes and develop clean energy so that power plant doesn't need to be built.
Climate change is not only a problem, it's an opportunity to unite. The age of competition is often past. The age of cooperation is dawning.
Those were the voices of some of the delegates to the unofficial Youth Summit on Climate Change held last week in Montreal, which ran concurrent with the official Summit of Nations discussing the Kyoto Protocol, which was most definitely not talking about overturning the economic and political order. But some environmentalists have come to realize that the corporate system and its domination of the nation state is a key barrier to implementing substantive, large-scale solutions. The Project on Corporations, Law, and Democracy were pioneers in this respect. And this week in our second hour, we'll hear from one of its founders, Dr. Virginia Rasmussen. Both she and our first guest, Canadian scholar Ian Angus, see a grassroots democracy as a necessary first step to solving the interrelated problems of environmental destruction, war, and general misery. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, or WMRW Warren. We begin with a dialogue between activist and scholar Ian Angus and C.S. Sung, host and co-producer of Against the Grain, a program heard on KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California. C.S. is one of the most insightful interviewers I've ever heard, and he brings his varied experience, years as a journalist, a stint as a lawyer, and now a master's candidate in philosophy, to bear in his work. Here's C.S. Sung.
At present, the established democratic institutions seem remarkably incapable of dealing effectively with the pressing social issues of our time. There is widespread disillusionment, apathy, and a sense of powerlessness. There are also active social movements vying for our attention and pressing for change with a striking vitality. I believe that it is with these movements that the hope for democracy rests. So writes Ian Angus in a book he wrote entitled Emergent Publics, an Essay on Social Movements and Democracy. Now, you might be thinking, wait a minute, democracy is about voting for our political representatives, something far removed from the organizing and activism of the often ignored left. Ian Angus wants you to think again. He is a professor of humanities at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, and he's been active in various social movements since the 1960s. He's also author of a number of books, including the one we'll focus on today, Emergent Publics. Before we jump into democracy as a radical idea and what it has to do with movements pressing for social change, let's talk about what kind of democracy we have today in our established institutions. How would you characterize it?
Well, it's normally called liberal democracy or representative democracy. And I think both of those are accurate terms. It's liberal in the sense that it goes along with the sense of the individual that goes with the high-intensity market society or capitalism. And it's representative in the sense that you don't go and make decisions yourself. You vote for somebody who then goes and makes those decisions for you.
And what kinds of elites drive this democracy? What kinds of decisions do they make based on what considerations?
Well, you know, I don't think it's a secret to anybody these days that almost everything is about money. The notion that capitalist society drives other values is something that the elites want to push upon us, but there's a large number of people, I think, nowadays who are disaffected with that. The notion that freedoms of the individual or freedoms from police brutality and so on come with a market society is something that the officials want us to believe, but I don't think many people really believe that anymore.
And you refer in your book to democracy as it currently exists in mainstream society as being kind of a formal rubber stamping of decisions already made by elites. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes. Well, I think that you have to look around. I think first step in understanding where you are is to look around and see where are the dominant forces, what are the dominant organizations in your society. And I think that the corporation is the major actor on our scene, and the corporation has its interests built into its organization, and it pursues those interests effectively. Now, the main interest is, of course, making money, and to some secondary sense attached to that, growth. These organizations affect our political process more than any other single factor, I would say.
If we move now to democracy in another sense, in what you call its more radical sense, maybe we first start with the word democracy and what it means.
Mm-hmm.
What's the literal meaning of democracy? What can we take from that?
Well, it comes from a Greek root, demos, which means the people, and krasi or kratic, which means a form of rule. So it means literally rule by the people. And in that sense, democracy has, I think, always been a radical idea. It's always attaching to the notion of democracy is at least potentially the notion of criticism of elite power. And I think one of the interesting things about our time is that on the one hand, it's a major legitimation for our political forms that they're supposed to be the forms in which the people rule. And yet there are always criticisms of that, which are themselves democratic. So the tension is right there in the word.
And with critique, I think of public discussion. And so what's the role of public discussion in maintaining a vibrant democracy?
Well, this is, again, a very key point, because many people nowadays seem to think that if they are asked about something, then they have participated. And there's a lot of power hidden in the notion of who asks the question, and specifically, what question do they ask? So that we know with public polls, for example, if people are asked a certain question, do you think the government should cut back taxes? Do you think they should spend money on this, that, the next thing? Everybody's in favor of cutting back taxes. But if you ask questions about, do you think that the nation state or the state should provide certain services with regards to health and well-being, people usually want that too. So there's a lot of power hidden in who asks the question. So participation is not just about getting to answer a question; it's about getting to formulate the question.
And by that criteria, I mean, when I go into a voting booth, I'm asked to choose between candidates that have already been selected. I'm asked to say yes or no to certain initiatives, say here in California, ballot measures. And there, I haven't necessarily been participated in the formulation of that question. It makes it sound rather hollow.
That's right. That's right. Now, I think there is a question in the kind of large societies we have now as to what extent one can participate in every decision that affects oneself. But that's really the criterion for democracy as a form of life, as opposed to just a representative political form, is the extent to which you're democratic, is the extent to which you can and do participate in all the decisions that affect your life. So this may not be actually 100% possible, but it's an ideal, and it's an ideal that I think drives many of the social movements of our time.
Okay, so what is the locus? What is the place in which this give and take of discussion and debate ought to take place?
Well, it ought to take place everywhere, but it doesn't. I think that the corporation is the major undemocratic force or anti-democratic force in our time, both domestically in terms of the way it influences political parties and the huge amount of money that has to be donated to parties for them to be viable on the national scene, or even the state or provincial scene. As a consequence, governments themselves are not that interested in people participating. They want business as usual, or they want the rubber stamped the population to go along with decisions that have been rubber stamped behind the closed doors. So I see social movements of our time as really mainly generating as a critique of that, and as proposing and discovering other ways of democratic participation. So while it should go on more widely, it actually, I think, there's quite often more democratic participation in the discussion over a kitchen table between people who are deciding to hand out leaflets in the street about something they disagree with or agree with, than there is in voting practices.
Ian Angus teaches humanities at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. His other books include Primal Scenes of Communication, Communication, Consumerism, and Social Movements, and Disfigurations, Discourse, Critique, Ethics. We're talking about a book he wrote entitled Emergent Publics, an Essay on Social Movements and Democracy, published by Arbeiter Ring. Right, the kitchen table, you also refer to coffee houses. Historically, you refer to public assemblies where people could come together and have that give-and-take discussion. What exactly should take place at such a venue? Or historically, what exactly has taken place?
Well, let me start with an example that may not be familiar to your listeners in the United States. When I referred to kitchen tables, I had in mind the movement that came out of the Cooperative Commonwealth Foundation here in Canada, which is a left-wing, originally anti-capitalist political party that now has become the New Democratic Party, what we might call a center-left party. In the 1930s, and through the 40s and 50s as well, there were kitchen table meetings in Saskatchewan where there was a lot of power, popular power based around the Cooperative Commonwealth Foundation. And this is where the idea for a public health care system was generated, around mostly rural people getting together and discussing the idea around their kitchen tables. It affected the Cooperative Commonwealth Foundation's political platform, and later the New Democratic Party, so that the Premier of Saskatchewan, Tommy Douglas, in the 1950s proposed this idea and eventually got it through. It later became a national program as the Liberals stole from the left, as the way they have done, to programs from the left to keep in power. And we have something now which has become very important to all Canadians and is something which they see as endangered at the present time, something to which they're very committed to preserving. Now, it's important to remember, from my point of view, that didn't start with government organizations and the people who discuss it today. It started with ordinary people looking at what they need and saying what we need more than anything else is protection from unemployment, and when we might be sick and we can't work, we need to know that the bills are going to be paid. That is, for us here in Canada, a major component of what contemporary democracy means to us. I think that's been shown by all sorts of polls and political discussions. The important thing is that it was no political party of itself thought of that or proposed it. No corporation did anything but oppose it. Yeah, and so where it came from was the people, the demos. And that's an important thing to remember nowadays, because people think that the world is driven by elites and their agendas. Now, those elites and agendas are very important because they affect us all. But for the viewpoint of democracy, from the viewpoint of the life of the ordinary people in the society, what they do and how they organize themselves still has an enormous effect. And the more you look over long-term history as opposed to short-term history, I think you can see that still.
Yeah, what about, I think of the kitchen table, right, that's a private home. What about the public sphere and expanding places within the public sphere, within places to which the public has access, expanding those for public interaction, public discussion?
Right. There are such places, and they change over time. But I think that we should avoid thinking of public places as simply kinds of places. It's actually the nature of the participation in them that makes them public. So that when somebody invites people around to their kitchen table to discuss an issue, that kitchen table becomes a public place. At that point in time, though it's in a private home, that person can't just exclude somebody they've had an argument with across their back fence last week if they're interested in the same issue. It becomes a public place. And coffee houses in the 18th century played a similar role. They became places of political discussion and ferment for the people who did not have established political positions. In France, and to some extent in Germany during the 18th century, but mostly in France, there was a phenomenon called salons. And these were in private homes, often of very privileged people, but quite often organized and maintained by women. And they had those homes became public places through the discussions that happened there, and had a much larger effect after that. So the notion of the public is not it is a place, but it's a place in which one engages in a certain way. A football field, for example, has lots and lots of people there, but it's not a public place.
I think back, and you refer to this in your book, Ian, about the public assemblies in the ancient Greek democracy, huge public assemblies where people came together and debated the issues of the day. Now, certain people were excluded, and you talk about that, and you critique that in your book. But some might argue that for radical democracy to work, we need kind of smaller political units. I mean, is it that communities and political entities are just too big now? It's not possible to know everyone or to interact with, a lot of other people?
Well, this is one of the biggest problems for democracy in our time, I think. A lot of establishment thinkers would have you believe that because of simply of size, there is no possibility for democracy at all, and the kind of plebiscitory democracy we have, non-participatory representative democracy, is the only possibility. Now, I think to some extent, anybody who thinks about democracy as participation has to be in favor of decentralization. Decentralization of decision making, and to some extent decentralization of organizations themselves. Nevertheless, decentralization can't mean simply isolation. It's hard to believe that we could have a Republic of Vancouver here, though we like to talk actually of a Republic of East Vancouver, which is where I live. Mm-hmm. But we can't literally be isolated or cut off from other places. So the real question is, what kind of association is going to with larger organizations is going to maximize democracy, as opposed to maximizing centralized top-down decision making? This is something that I think that the answer to that question is going to take a long time and a lot of historical experience to really sort out. But I think that the social movements more recently are starting to have some very good ideas about that.
Mm. And I'm going to ask you much more about social movements in relation to democracy in a little while later. What does, in your mind, what does consumer culture do to the tendency of people to consult one another in public spaces?
Right. Well, you see, if you think about democracy as a form of life, as opposed to just a practice one engages in once in a while, you have to see that democracy requires a certain way of acting towards other people, a certain social, what we call in the university, a social identity. And we've all heard a lot about identity politics in the last 20 years or so. There is, I think, a certain democratic identity, a way of relating to other people that certain participatory practices encourage and certain others don't. Now, if you look at it that way, again, you have to look at the society more generally and say, well, what form of identity does the society encourage? And I think that for a whole lot of reasons, which, if you like, I can go into, I think it's best to define our contemporary society as a consumer capitalist society.
Please elaborate.
Elaborate. Yeah. It's capitalist in the sense that the form of production of goods is privately owned and produced for profit. And it's consumer-oriented as opposed to, for example, 19th or early 20th century capitalism, in the sense that the big problem for selling goods nowadays is what's called in Marxist terms the realization of capital as opposed to the realization of profit as opposed to the production of profit itself. In other words, the goods have to be sold. And the big problem in selling goods is, of course, not that there's lots of people out there who need them. There's always lots of people who need stuff. We know that very well. But only people who've got the money can buy it. And the people who've got the money have got lots of options as to what they buy. So we have the whole generation of the advertising industry, which is basically an industry of popular propaganda, designed to get people to buy the stuff that the corporations want them to buy. I think that this has gone so far that we can say that there's a form of the dominant form of identity formation within consumer capitalism is through the process of buying and selling. Malls have taken on a significance for people. People actually go to malls and places like that when they have spare time. I find it a little hard to understand myself, but there you have it. So the society, in its top-down form of organization, prefers consumer identities. And this is, again, social movements are important because they disrupt the formation of consumer identities.
And the choices you make as a consumer, as you mentioned in your book, are isolated. They don't involve consulting with other people. You are merely looking at your own preferences and desires and sometimes needs.
That's right.
Right.
That's right, exactly. And the most important thing about a decision of what I'm going to buy is that I do not have to justify it to anybody. If I've got the money, I buy my salami or my tennis shoes, and it's not up to anybody else to have any say in that. Now, there is a place in society for certain decisions which you don't have to justify, but let's look at consumer decisions now. People buy shirts. They don't know that those shirts are made in sweatshop labor factories in free trade zones in Southeast Asia or in Mexico. They don't know. We don't have information about these goods. Now, we have had in recent years the fair trade movement over coffee, I think, is an important recent example, ways in which consumers are trying to educate themselves about the origin of the things they buy and make those decisions more socially responsible. Now, I think that this is, again, an important intervention in the basic social processes.
If we can get back to this idea, and I'm quoting here now from your book, that public interaction is a precondition for the practice of democracy. Public interaction, Ian, sometimes involves agreement. It sometimes involves disagreement or a conflict. And in that sense, you write that democracy has a civilizing function in relation to conflict. Can you point out what you mean by that?
Yes. Well, I think one of the things that has been difficult for people who have a positive view of social movements in recent years is that we've seen a number of powerful social movements of the right engage in some very destructive practices, including genocide and so on around the world. And one has to keep an eye on that and be aware that social movements can and do sometimes have a nasty side. So one can't sort of assume that social movements necessarily are good, even though they do, I think, play a role in any case in disrupting the ordinary forms of identity formation. So one has to analyze, I think, what makes these things become destructive under certain circumstances in certain places. And it's, I think, a certain kind of exclusivity, a certain kind of viewing of the other as utterly different from me. And the classic case of this is, of course, Nazism in fascist Germany. And the Jew, or the gypsy, or the homosexual, all the people who were seen as not part of the true German character were pushed outside, and ultimately very extreme forms of violence visited upon them. Now, if you look at that, there are some similarities to genocidal tendencies in contemporary societies. And the way in which it occurs is through this utter pushing aside of the other's identity. Now, a democracy as participation is a form of discussion and debate. And to debate someone, you have to, in a certain sense, recognize them as like yourself. That is, amenable to persuasion, going to be able to understand the concerns that you articulate. And in that sense, I think that democracy in the participatory sense is civilizing in that it tends to make us view the other as someone more like us than different. And certainly not radically different in such a way that would encourage fascistic sorts of violence.
There's a lot of talk about emphasis on peace, agreement, and consensus. And you write about utopian lines of thought that argue for an end to all conflict. Your opinion?
Well, it's the desire, the utopian desire is very important. And I think that in many humans have a hope of a society or a possible situation in which conflict is finished. And I think that this is often expressed in religious forms. And we have to keep in mind that this is many times a very positive thing. It's what motivates people, and many times to try to see their neighbors as people who of concern, to concern themselves with other people. So I don't want to just knock the idea of utopia. But modern societies have also produced this utopian notion that we could all be in agreement, or we could all be the same in the end. And this is a problem if you see it as something which could actually be realized. Democracy has to accept the disagreement, even fundamental disagreement, it seems to me, and it can only by doing so allow for the demos in the Greek sense to have differences, to accept the differences of different groups. Democracy for the Greeks, and in many cases throughout history, has been an expression of a more or less homogeneous group. And it's difficult sometimes for democracies to accept deep differences amongst people. So this is a tension. It's not something I think is ever ultimately resolved. And the thing about that worries me about utopia is the notion that we could ultimately resolve the differences between people. And that, I think, is the dangerous idea for some of the reasons I was sketching before.
And we're speaking with Ian Angus, professor of humanities at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia, longtime activist and author of the book Emergent Publics, an essay on social movements and democracy. You can find a link to that book and to a lot more on our website, againstthegrain.org. And we're talking about democracy, and we're talking about what democracy means in its radical sense, perhaps in its truest sense, and what its relationship is to social movements, to movements like feminism and the civil rights movement and the environmental movement and the appropriate technology movement. You focus on a particular historical trend in this book, Ian, which is the breakdown of the post-World War II consensus, and this is around the desirability of the welfare state. Why go into that history?
Well, I think a lot of contemporary struggles are now about the withdrawal of welfare state services from people in first world capitalist countries. Issues of within the welfare state, it was understood that there was a basic minimum that all members of that society could expect. And that minimum has been dropping considerably. We've all seen more and more homeless people on our streets, and cutbacks of social services, which make the contemporary situation much worse for people and much less secure for people than it was 20 or 30 years ago. So that is the immediate background that we're working against. And it's also the focus for a lot of struggles as a consequence.
I see. And so with this coincident rise of new social movements, what are you trying to say about what the social movements are and what impact they are having on not just maybe their own constituents, you know, the activists within their ranks, but the public at large?
Right. Well, one thing that I just forgot to say in relation to your last question, and this is important because it has to do, I think, with one of the things that's distinctive about the way I approach social movements, is I see the main issue as a question of identity. Now, that's not to be opposed to material questions, because there are always material questions involved in social movements. People want such and such. Here locally, we wanted to stop a cement plant that wanted to put in a plant that was near a swimming pool that kids were using, and it would have put a lot of lime in the air and affected the swimming pool. There's always something material at issue, right? But I think that it's important to analyze social movements in terms of identity formation as part and parcel of the struggle over material issues.
So give us an example.
Let me go back to the previous question a bit and give some background.
Sure.
The other thing that's important about the welfare state is it created a sort of a citizen identity by including people and providing a basic minimum, economic minimum for people. It gave them a certain stake in the society and made them feel like members in a certain way. Now, there were always lots of problems to it and certain limitations, but I think that's the background of contemporary situation. Now, social movements like feminism or environmentalism have created other opposed identities, and it's no accident that these movements have become very important in the same era as the decline of the welfare state and the decline of a citizen identity. So I think that, for example, when I was a student in the late 1960s, there was no such thing as feminism. There wasn't a voice for it. There were no organizations and so on. There did at a certain point in time arise a thing called women's liberation amongst women active in the New Left. And this is eventually, through a long history, you know, which is now reasonably well known and talked about, created an identity of someone as a feminist. A feminist is now a thing you can either be or not be. You can be for it or you can be against it. It exists as a certain identity, a knowable social thing. Now, this is an incredible production of something, an incredible success story, really, in creating a new way for people to identify, and a positive way for women to identify with their sense of themselves, which is different from a consumer sense, which is different from being a housewife, which is different from the citizen identity of the welfare state.
And you're saying
that piece of music, by the way, that you played, it was a terrific piece of music to choose. The fellow says there, "I want that the world should know who I am." And I think we all do want that. And the social movements allow us a way of showing who we are and becoming something different than we were, the possibilities we were offered. So this is why these movements are not just external things, but they're very important to the way people live their lives.
Mm. And so overall, would you say the success of social movements in infiltrating maybe the broader culture with identities, new identities like a feminist or environmentalist, that overall there's been, a great deal of success in changing people's mindsets, regular people's mindsets?
Well, yes, I do think so. And this is one of the things that's been said about this little book by a number of reviewers and commentators, is that it seems a very optimistic book in which there are not very many optimistic books these days. So, but I believe that social movements have an importance that goes way beyond the number of people involved. If I'm right that they set in motion new processes of identity formation, this would explain why somebody who passes through and becomes an environmentalist for a couple of years in their life when they're in their 20s and then isn't active afterwards, nevertheless is profoundly influenced by this and becomes a different human being than they would have been otherwise. So I think that the huge influence of social movements in changing the public, the public sense of what's possible, and in changing individuals' expectations for their own lives has to do with the fact that even if you're passed through this for a short period of time, something happens to you that you don't actually forget. And it's not a static thing. I don't become an environmentalist and then never change. You know, one is engaged in a certain different sort of questioning about one's life. And I think that that stays with many people. But you have to look at the long term. We have to look at the long term. One can lose battles, but still be winning a certain war, if you want to continue the metaphor, with regards to the identity formation process. Believe me, I finished high school in 1967. If the culture that existed in North America in 1967 had continued without being disrupted by the social movements, we would be living in outright hell now, you know. The possibilities open to people are much, much wider than they would have been without those movements.
You refer to kind of you call it an internal public sphere, internal public spheres of social movements, that there's a way they come to operate and conduct their discussions and debates and give and takes that is internal, but then in some way, and maybe you could explain this mechanism, they leak out into the broader public, the broader established social institutions, political institutions, economic institutions, and they introduce or invent new forms of public interaction. Can you, you know, lay that out for us?
Yes, I was interested in this because I was not, for a couple of reasons, I was not satisfied with the way people thought about the public sphere as always the general one public sphere that exists in a society or doesn't exist in a totalitarian circumstance. And it was actually a piece of writing by Nancy Fraser, the feminist political theorist, that influenced me a lot on this. And she pointed out, through reflecting on the feminist movement, that they had created different sorts of publics. That feminism, for example, can a common feminist identity can bring together people. For example, in a women's studies department at the university, at a rape relief shelter downtown, and another group that's fighting for more access by women to positions in community centers and so on, more facilities, can bring them all together. Now, that's the creation not of something that's general to the whole society, but it's held together by a feminist commitment, you know, the feminist identity. And so I've started to look at things with this in mind, and I started to see, well, environmentalist groups do that too in a certain way. And it, within these public spheres, these internal public spheres to movements, certain languages are developed. People, through their long process of discussing and being active and protesting, they create languages that work for them, you know, ways of talking about the situation that work for the activist and for the person concerned about certain issues. And that, and this is done also through media of communication, which work within these movements, pamphlets, meetings, face-to-face meetings quite often. But they're also broadcast, as it were, and I'm sure that your station sees itself as in some way doing this, as does Co-op Radio in Vancouver. These understandings within the movements are broadcast and to the society at large and start to influence the society at large as well. So the notion of a public sphere is actually a much more dynamic thing than simply than it had been talked about until recently as something that's simply there for as part of the decision-making process of the society as a whole. there are many different small public spheres. Some of them are related to ethnic and linguistic groups as well, and the newspapers that function in those communities. And they interact with the larger society and the larger public debate. An example that I use in the book is a short essay. There's by the Norwegian philosopher Arne Næss, who is a wonderful environmentalist philosopher and has written a lot of huge books about it and given umpteen talks. He wrote a paper that was only 7 pages long called The Shallow Environmentalist Movement and the Deep Long-Range Ecology Movement. He wrote this in 1973. And that 7 pages has been all everywhere in mm-hmm. in the environmental movement mm-hmm. around the world. And it's provided a concept, deep ecology, which has profoundly influenced the lives of many people. They've started to wonder about whether they have an ethical responsibility to non-human beings. Now, I'm not saying that Arne Næss created this himself. That's not the way I want to put it. Many people were ready to hear this. You know, they were looking for it. Maybe they had co-invented the idea. But this particular essay, which most professional philosophers would have never heard of, had its own reception and discussion within the internal sphere of a movement, and in that sense had an important impact that really couldn't have had in any other way. And I think that many people are looking, have this in mind, you know, when they're doing things, the kind of sort of audience I had in mind when I was writing Emergent Publics. I wanted to in some way talk to my fellow activists about some of the conclusions I'd come to.
It's one thing. We're joined by Ian Angus on Against the Grain. We're talking about his book, Emergent Publics, an essay on social movements and democracy. His other books include Primal Scenes of Communication, Disfigurations, and A Border Within, National Identity, Cultural Plurality, and Wilderness. You can find links to all these books, as, of course, also Emergent Publics, on Ian Angus's website. That's ianangus.ca, or you can just go to againstthegrain.org, and you can find links there. I'm C.S. Sung. It's one thing to say, Ian, that contemporary democracy relies on social movements, and that social movements add an element or add many elements from their own processes, from their own constituencies, into the broader culture. It's another thing to argue, and this is what you have argued, that democracy historically has actually emerged from social movements. Uh-huh. Maybe a lot of people wouldn't follow that line of reasoning.
Well, I think if you look back, it becomes more credible if one looks at the history. And this is one of the things. I mean, what I wrote was not a history book, but I do refer back to some examples. If you see things as in process, it's easier to understand the way in which activism and social movements has had a bigger impact than one thinks that it has had. For example, the democracy now, even our official democracy, wouldn't be what it is without the workers' movement of the 19th century. Without the workers agitating first to get the right to vote, and then using that right to vote to put their agendas onto the political scene, we wouldn't have economic questions like minimum wage, which now in every nation in the world, that's a political issue because there is such a thing as a minimum wage. The nation state, through its power, has intervened in the economic system, and the reason it intervened is not because they just like to. It's because political parties emerged which were promoting an agenda based upon the workers' interests. Now, of course, this doesn't end the story. Once that's come onto the stage and there is a battle over the minimum wage, well, occasionally one loses, more than occasionally recently, and the minimum wage is not as high as it ought to be. But it's my point here is that it becomes a political issue. Once it is a political issue, something radical has changed. Something radically important has happened. We've come to accept as a society, that the there is such a thing as a minimum wage, there is such a thing as the a political decision-making process that enters the economy. One, to some extent, has to by looking at it historically, you can look at the way in which the agenda has changed. We haven't won every battle, but when you look at the changing agenda, I think you see a bit of a more positive story.
Mm. When I think of radical philosophy and politics and theory, like socialism or anarchism or feminism, do you find a certain idea or notion within one of these theories especially valuable and helpful to what you want democracy to evolve into?
I find that a bit hard to answer, and I'll tell you why. I've for many years after the 60s, for probably about 15 years till the early 80s, I would have considered myself an independent Marxist. By independent, I mean not Leninist, not Maoist, but I would have seen Marxism as the most developed form of radical thought. But I came to the conclusion somewhere in the 80s that for certain specific reasons I perhaps don't need to go into, Marxism had some weak points as a theory. And I think that the conclusion I've come to in the end is that very often these isms, whether it be Marxism, socialism, anarchism, they can play a clarifying function for us, but we must not be trapped by them. You know, it's the most important thing is to see what's happening in your own time as clearly as you can, and to respond to it, to contribute to it.